This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Armada by Ernest Cline. Read for you by Will Wheaton. Phase 1. The only legitimate use of a computer is to play games. Eugene Jarvis, creator of Defender. 1. I was staring out the classroom window and daydreaming of adventure when I spotted the flying saucer. I blinked and looked again, but it was still out there, a shiny chrome disc zigzagging around in the sky. My eyes struggled to track the object through a series of increasingly fast, impossibly sharp turns that would have juiced a human being had there been any aboard. The disc streaked toward the distant horizon, then came to an instantaneous stop just above it. It hovered there, motionless, over the distant tree line for a few seconds, as if scanning the area beneath it with an invisible beam, before it abruptly launched itself skyward again, making another series of physics-defying changes to its course and speed. I tried to keep my cool. I tried to remain skeptical. I reminded myself that I was a man of science, even if I did usually get a C in it. I looked at it again. I still couldn't tell what it was, but I knew what it wasn't. It wasn't a meteor, or a weather balloon, or swamp gas, or ball lightning. No, the unidentified flying object I was staring at with my own two eyes was most definitely not of this Earth. My first thought was, "Holy fucking shit!" Followed immediately by, "I can't believe it's finally happening!" You see, ever since the first day of kindergarten, I had been hoping and waiting for some mind-blowingly fantastic, world-altering event to finally shatter the endless monotony of my public education. I had spent hundreds of hours gazing out at the calm, Concord suburban landscape surrounding my school, silently yearning for the outbreak of a zombie apocalypse, a freak accident that would give me superpowers, or perhaps the sudden appearance of a band of time-traveling kleptomaniac dwarves. I would estimate that approximately one-third of these dark daydreams of mine had involved the unexpected arrival of beings from another world. Of course, I'd never believed it would really happen. Even if alien visitors did decide to drop by this utterly insignificant little blue-green planet, no self-respecting extraterrestrial would ever pick my hometown of Beaverton, Oregon, a.k.a. Yawnsville, USA, as their point of first contact. Not unless their plan was to destroy our civilization by wiping out our least interesting locales first. If there was a bright center to the universe, I was on the planet it was farthest from. Please pass the blue milk, Aunt Beru. But now, something miraculous was happening here. It was still happening right now. There was a goddamn flying saucer out there. I was staring right at it. And I was pretty sure it was getting closer. I cast a furtive glance back over my shoulder at my two best friends, Cruz and Deal, who were both seated behind me. But they were currently engaged in a whispered debate, and neither of them was looking toward the windows. I considered trying to get their attention, but I was worried the object might vanish any second, and I didn't want to miss my chance to see this for myself. My gaze shot back outside, just in time to see another bright flash of silver as the craft streaked laterally across the landscape, then halted and hovered over an adjacent patch of terrain before zooming off again. Hover, move, hover, move. It was definitely getting closer. I could see its shape in more detail now. The saucer banked sideways for a few seconds, and I got my first clear glimpse of its top-down profile, and I saw that it wasn't really a saucer at all. From this angle, I could see that its symmetrical hull resembled the blade of a two-headed battle axe, and that a black octagonal prism lay centered between its long, serrated wings, glinting in the morning sunlight like a dark jewel. That was when I felt my brain begin to short circuit, because there was no mistaking the craft's distinctive design. After all, I'd seen it almost every night for the past few years through a targeting reticle. I was looking at a Sobrukai Glaive, one of the fighter ships piloted by the alien bad guys in Armada, my favorite video game. Which was, of course, impossible, like seeing a TIE fighter or a Klingon warbird cruising across the sky. The Sobrukai and their Glaive fighters were fictional video game creations. They didn't exist in the real world. They couldn't. In reality, video games did not come to life, and fictional spaceships did not buzz your hometown. Implausible shit like that only happened in cheesy 80s movies, like Tron or War Games or The Last Starfighter. The sorts of movies my late father had been nuts about. The gleaming craft banked sideways again, and this time I got an even better look. There was no doubt about it. I was looking at a glaive, right down to the distinctive claw-like grooves along its fuselage and the twin plasma cannons protruding from the front end like two fangs. There was only one logical explanation for what I was seeing. I had to be hallucinating. And I knew what sort of people suffered from hallucinations in broad daylight without any help from drugs or alcohol. People who were cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs, that's who. Cats with a serious marble deficiency. I'd long wondered if my father had been one such person because of what I'd read in one of his old journals. The things I'd seen there had given me the impression that he'd become somewhat delusional near the end of his life. That he may have even lost the ability to differentiate between video games and reality. The very same problem I now seemed to be experiencing myself. Maybe it was just as I had always secretly feared. The apple had fallen right next to the crazy tree. Had I been drugged? No, impossible. All I'd eaten that morning was a raw strawberry Pop-Tart I'd wolfed down in my car on the way to school. And the only thing crazier than hallucinating a fictional video game spaceship would be to blame it on a frosted breakfast pastry. Especially if I knew my own DNA was a far more likely culprit. This was my own fault, I realized. I could have taken precautions, but instead I'd done the opposite. Like my old man, I'd spent my entire life overdosing on uncut escapism, willingly allowing fantasy to become my reality. And now, like my father before me, I was paying the price for my lack of vision. I was going off the rails on a crazy train. You could practically hear Ozzy screaming, "All aboard!" "Don't do this," I pleaded with myself. "Don't crack up now when we've only got 2 months to go until graduation. This is the home stretch, Lightman. Keep it together." Outside the window, the Glaive fighter streaked laterally again. As it zoomed over a cluster of tall trees, I saw their branches rustle in its wake. Then it zipped through another cloud bank, moving so fast it punched a perfect circular hole through its center, dragging several long wisps of cloud vapor along with it as it tore out the other side. A second later, the craft froze in midair one last time before it streaked straight upward in a silver blur, vanishing from sight as quickly as it had appeared. I just sat there for a moment, unable to do more than stare at the empty patch of sky where it had been a second earlier. Then I glanced around at the other students seated nearby. No one else was looking in the direction of the windows. If that Glaive fighter had really been out there, no one else had seen it. I turned back and scanned the empty sky once again, praying for the strange silver craft to reappear. But it was long gone. And now, here I was, forced to deal with the aftermath. Seeing that Glaive fighter, or imagining I'd seen it, had triggered a small rock slide in my mind that was already growing into a crushing avalanche of conflicting emotions and fragmented memories, all of them linked to my father and that old journal I'd found among his things. Actually, I wasn't even sure it had been a journal. I'd never finished reading it. I'd been too disturbed by its contents and what they'd seemed to imply about the author's mental state. So I'd put the old notebook back where I found it and tried to forget that it even existed. And until a few seconds ago, I had succeeded. But now I couldn't seem to think about anything else. I felt a sudden compulsion to run out of the school, drive home, and find it. It wouldn't take long. My house was only a few minutes away. I glanced over at the exit, and the man guarding it, Mr. Sales, our elderly integrated mathematics 2 teacher. He had a silver buzz cut, thick, horn-rimmed glasses, and wore the same monochromatic outfit he always did. Black loafers, black slacks, a white short-sleeve dress shirt, and a black clip-on necktie. He'd been teaching at this high school for over 45 years now, and the old yearbook photos in the library were proof that he'd been rocking this same retro ensemble the entire time. Mr. S was finally retiring this year, which was a good thing because he appeared to have run out of shits to give sometime in the previous century. Today, he'd spent the first 5 minutes going over our homework assignment, then given us the rest of the period to work on it, while he shut off his hearing aid and did his crosswords. But he would still spot me if I tried to sneak out. My eyes moved to the ancient clock embedded in the lime-green brick wall above the obsolete chalkboard. With its usual lack of pity, it informed me that there were still 32 minutes remaining until the bell. There was no way I could take 32 more minutes of this. After what I'd just seen, I'd be lucky if I managed to keep my shit together for another 32 seconds. Off to my left, Douglas Notcher was currently engaged in his daily humiliation of Casey Cox, the shy, acne-plagued kid unfortunate enough to be seated in front of him. Notcher usually limited himself to lobbing verbal insults at the poor guy, but today he'd decided to go old school and lob spitballs at him instead. Notcher had a stack of moist projectiles piled on his desk like cannonballs, and he was currently firing them at the back of Casey's head, one after another. The back of the poor kid's hair was already damp with spit from Notcher's previous attacks. A couple of Notcher's pals were watching from the back of the room, and they snickered each time he nailed Casey with another projectile, egging him on. It drove me nuts when Notcher bullied Casey like this, which, I suspected, was one of the reasons Notcher enjoyed doing it so much. He knew I couldn't do a damn thing about it. I glanced at Mr. Sales, but he was still lost in his crossword, clueless as always, a fact that Notcher took advantage of on a daily basis. And on a daily basis, I had to resist the urge to knock his teeth down his throat. Doug Notcher and I had managed to avoid each other, for the most part, ever since the incident back in junior high. Until this year, when a cruel act of fate had landed us both in the same math class, seated in adjacent rows, no less. It was almost as if the universe wanted my last semester of high school to be as hellish as possible. That would have also explained why my ex-girlfriend, Ellen Adams, was in this class too. 3 rows to my right and 2 rows back, sitting just beyond the reach of my peripheral vision. Ellen was my first love, and we'd lost our virginity to each other. It had been nearly 2 years since she'd dumped me for some wrestler from a neighboring school, but every time I saw those freckles across the bridge of her nose, or caught sight of her tossing that curly red hair out of her eyes, I felt my heart breaking all over again. I usually spent the entire class period trying to forget she was in the room. Being forced to sit between my mortal enemy and my ex-girlfriend every afternoon made seventh period math feel like my own private Kobayashi Maru, a brutal no-win scenario designed to test my emotional fortitude. Thankfully, fate had balanced out the nightmare equation slightly by placing my two best friends in this class, too. If Cruz and Deal hadn't been assigned here, I probably would have snapped and started hallucinating shit midway through my first week. I glanced back at them again. Deal, who was tall and thin, and Cruz, who was short and stocky, both shared the same first name, Michael. Ever since grade school, I had been calling them by their last names to avoid confusion. The Mikes were still engaged in the same whispered conversation they'd been having earlier, before I'd zoned out and started seeing things. A debate over the coolest melee weapon in the history of cinema. I tried to focus in on their voices again now. "Sting wasn't even really a sword," Deal was saying. "It was more like a glow-in-the-dark hobbit butter knife used to spread jam on scones and lembas bread and shit." Cruz rolled his eyes. "Your love of the halfling's leaf has clearly slowed your mind," he quoted. Sting was an elvish blade forged in Gondolin in the First Age. It could cut through almost anything, and its blade only glowed when it detected the presence of orcs or goblins nearby. What does Mjolnir detect? Fake accents and frosted hair? I wanted to tell them what I'd just seen, but best friends or not, there was no way in hell they'd believe me. They'd think of it as another symptom of their pal Zack's psychological instability. And maybe it was, too. Thor doesn't need to detect his enemies so he can run off and hide in his little hobbit hole, Diehl whispered. Mjolnir is powerful enough to destroy mountains, and it can also emit energy blasts, create force fields, and summon lightning. The hammer also always returns to Thor's hand after he throws it, even if it has to tear through an entire planet to get back to him, and only Thor can wield it. He leaned back. Dude, Mjolnir is a bullshit magical Swiss army knife, Cruz said. Even worse than Green Lantern's ring. They give that hammer a new power every other week just to get Thor out of whatever asinine fix they've written him into, he smirked. By the way, lots of other people have wielded Mjolnir, including Wonder Woman in a crossover issue. Google it. Your whole argument is invalid, Deal. For the record, my own personal choice would have probably been Excalibur, as depicted in the film of the same name. But I didn't have the heart to join the debate. Instead, my attention drifted back over to Notcher, who was in the process of lobbing another giant spitball at Casey. It nailed him in the back of his already damp head, then fell to the floor, where it joined the soggy pile of previously fired missiles that had already collected there. Casey went rigid for a second on impact, but he didn't turn around. He just sank back down into his seat while his tormentor prepared another saliva salvo. There was an obvious connection between Notcher's behavior and the abusive drunk he had for a father, but the cause of his sadistic behavior didn't excuse it, in my opinion. I clearly had a few daddy issues myself, but you didn't see me pulling the wings off of flies. On the other hand, I did have a slight anger management problem and a related history of physical violence, both well-documented by the public school system. And, that whole hallucinating alien spacecraft from my favorite video game thing. So, perhaps I wasn't in the best position to judge the sanity of others. I looked around at my classmates. Everyone in the vicinity was staring at Casey now, probably wondering if this would be the day he'd finally stand up to Notcher. But Casey just kept glancing up at Mr. Sales, who was still engrossed in his crossword, oblivious to the intense adolescent drama unfolding in front of him. Notcher launched another spitball, and Casey sank even lower into his seat, almost like he was melting. I tried to do what I'd been doing all semester. I tried to manage my anger, to focus my attention elsewhere and mind my own business. But I couldn't, and I didn't. Watching Notcher torment Casey while the rest of us just sat and watched filled me not only with self-loathing, but with disgust for my whole species. If there were other civilizations out there, why would they ever want to make contact with humanity? If this was how we treated each other, how much kindness could we possibly show to some race of bug-eyed beings from beyond? A clear image of the Glaive Fighter reappeared in my mind, cranking up the tension in my nerves a few more notches. I tried to calm them once again, this time by reminding myself of the Drake equation and the Fermi paradox. I knew there was probably life elsewhere, but given the vast size and age of the universe, I also knew how astronomically unlikely it was we would ever make contact with it, much less within the narrow window of my own lifetime. We were all probably stuck here for the duration on the third rock from our sun, boldly going extinct. I felt a sharp pain in my jaw and realized I was clenching my teeth, hard enough to crack my back molars. With some effort, I unclenched them. Then I glanced back at Ellen to see if she was watching all of this. She was staring at Casey with a helpless expression, and her eyes were filled with pity. That was what finally pushed me over the edge. "Zack, what are you doing?" I heard Deal ask in a panicked whisper. "Sit down!" I glanced down. Without realizing it, I'd gotten up from my desk. My eyes were still locked on Notcher and Casey. "Yeah, stay out of it," Cruz whispered over my other shoulder. "Come on, man." But by that point, a red film of rage had already slipped down across my vision. When I reached Notcher, I didn't do what I wanted to, which was to grab him by his hair and slam his face into his desktop as hard as I could again and again. Instead, I reached down and scooped up the soggy pile of gray spitballs resting on the floor behind Casey's chair. I used both hands to pack them all together in a single wet ball, then slapped it down directly on top of Notcher's head. It made an extremely satisfying splat sound. Notcher jumped up and spun around to face his attacker, but he froze when he saw my face staring back at him. His eyes went wide, and he seemed to turn slightly pale. A collective, "Ooh," emanated from our classmates. Everyone knew what had happened between me and Notcher back in junior high, and they were all electrified by the possibility of a rematch. Seventh period integrated math had just gotten a hell of a lot more exciting. Notcher reached up and clawed the wet ball of chewed up napkins off his head. Then he hurled it angrily across the room, unintentionally pelting half a dozen people. We locked eyes. I noticed a rivulet of Notcher's own spittle dripping down the left side of his face. He wiped it away, still keeping his eyes on me. "Finally decided to stick up for your boyfriend, Lightman," he muttered, doing a poor job of concealing the unsteadiness in his voice. I bared my teeth and lunged a step forward, cocking my right fist back. It had the desired effect. Notcher didn't just flinch. He lurched backward, tripping over his own chair and nearly falling to the floor. But then he righted himself and faced off with me again, his cheeks now flushed in embarrassment. The classroom was now dead silent, save for the incessant click of the electric wall clock, ticking off the seconds. "Do it," I thought. "Give me an excuse. Throw a punch." But I could see the fear growing in Notcher's eyes, subsuming his anger. Maybe he could tell from the look in my own eyes that I was on the verge of coming unhinged. "Psycho," he muttered under his breath. Then he turned and sat down, flipping me the bird over his shoulder. I realized my right fist was still raised. When I finally lowered it, the entire class seemed to exhale in unison. I glanced at Casey, expecting him to offer me a nod of thanks, but he was still cowering at his desk like a whipped dog, and he wouldn't make eye contact with me. I stole another glance at Ellen. She was staring right at me this time, but she immediately looked away, refusing to meet my gaze. I scanned the rest of the classroom. The only two people who would make eye contact with me were Cruz and Deal, and they both wore expressions of concern. That was when Mr. Sales finally looked up from his crossword and noticed me hovering over Notcher like an axe murderer. He fumbled with his hearing aid and powered it back on. Then he looked back at me, then at Notcher, then back at me again. "What's going on, Lightman?" he asked, leveling a crooked finger at me. When I didn't respond, he frowned. "Back in your seat. Now." But I couldn't do that. If I stayed here 1 second longer, my skull was going to implode. So I walked out of the classroom, passing right in front of Mr. Sales' desk on my way out the open door. He watched me go, eyebrows raised in disbelief. "You better be on your way to the office, mister," he shouted after me. I was already sprinting for the nearest exit, disrupting one class after another with the staccato screech of my sneaker soles on the waxed corridor floor. After what seemed like an eternity, I finally burst out of the school's main entrance. As I ran for the student parking lot, I swept my gaze back and forth across the sky from one horizon to the other. To anyone watching from inside the school, I must have looked like a complete mental case, spectating some tennis match between giants that I alone could see. Or maybe like Don Quixote, tilting at a few windmills before he gave them the La Mancha beatdown. My car was parked near the back of the lot. It was a white 1989 Dodge Omni that had once belonged to my father, covered in dents, dings, peeling paint, and large patches of rust. It had sat neglected under a tarp in our garage throughout my childhood, until my mother had tossed me the keys on my 16th birthday. I'd accepted the gift with mixed feelings, and not just because it was a rusted-out eyesore that barely ran. It also happened to be the car in which I was conceived. while it was parked in the very same lot where I now stood, coincidentally. An unfortunate bit of trivia that my mother let slip one Valentine's Day, after too much wine and one too many back-to-back viewings of Say Anything. In vino veritas. Doubly true in my mother's case when a Cameron Crowe movie was added to the mix. Anyway, now the Omni belonged to me. Life is a circle, I suppose. And free wheels are free wheels, especially to a broke high school kid. I just did my best not to think about my teenage parents going at it in the back seat while Peter Gabriel crooned to them on the tape deck. Yes, the car still had a functioning tape deck. I had an adapter cable for it, so I could play music off my phone, but I preferred to listen to my father's old mixtapes instead. His favorite bands had become my favorites, too. ZZ Top, AC/DC, Van Halen, Queen. I fired up the Omni's mighty four-cylinder engine, and Power Station's cover of Get It On, Bang a Gong began to blare out its half-blown speakers. I hauled ass home as fast as I could, weaving through the maze of shady suburban streets at what was probably an unsafe speed, especially since I spent most of the trip looking up instead of at the road in front of me. It was still only mid-afternoon, but a nearly full moon was already faintly visible overhead, and my gaze kept locking onto it as I scanned the heavens. As a result, I almost ran two stop signs during the short drive home, then came within a few inches of getting broadsided by an SUV when I coasted through a red light. After that, I put on my hazard lights and drove the last few miles at a crawl, still craning my neck out the window, unable to keep my eyes off the sky. 2. I parked in the empty driveway and killed the engine, but I didn't get out of the car right away. Instead, I sat there gripping the wheel with both hands, peering silently up at the attic window of our little ivy-covered brick house, thinking about the first time I'd gone up there to dig through my father's old possessions. I'd felt like a young Clark Kent, preparing to finally learn the truth about his origins from the holographic ghost of his own long-dead father. But now I was thinking of a young Jedi in training named Luke Skywalker, looking into the mouth of that cave on Dagobah, while Master Yoda told him about today's activity lesson.
Strong with the dark side of the Force, that place is. In you must go, mofo.
So in I went. When I unlocked the front door of our house and stepped into the living room, Muffet, our ancient beagle, glanced up at me sleepily from where he was stretched out on the rug. A few years earlier, he would have been waiting for me just inside the door, yapping like a madman, but the poor guy had now grown so old and deaf that my arrival barely woke him. Muffet rolled onto his back, and I gave his tummy a few quick rubs before heading upstairs. The old dog watched me go, but didn't follow. When I finally reached the attic door, I just stood there at the top of the stairs with one hand on the doorknob. I didn't open the door. I didn't go in. Not right away. First, I needed a moment to prepare myself. His name was Xavier Ulysses Lightman, and he died when he was only 19 years old. I was still just a baby at the time, so I didn't remember him. Growing up, I'd always told myself that was lucky, because you can't miss someone you don't even remember. But the truth was I did miss him. And I'd attempted to fill the void created by his absence with data, by absorbing every scrap of information about him that I could. Sometimes it felt like I was trying to earn the right to miss him with the same intensity my mom and his parents had always seemed to. When I was around 10 years old, I entered what I thought of now as my GARP phase. That was when my lifelong curiosity about my late father gradually blossomed into a full-blown obsession. Up until that point, I'd made do with a vague, idealized image of my young father that had gradually formed in my mind over the years. But in actuality, I really only knew four basic facts about him, the same four things I'd heard over and over again throughout my childhood, mostly from my grandparents. 1. I looked just like him when he was, insert my current age. 2. He had loved me and my mother very much. 3. He died in an on-the-job accident at the local wastewater treatment plant. 4. The accident supposedly wasn't his fault. But once my age reached double digits, these vague details were no longer sufficient to satisfy my growing curiosity about him. So, naturally, I began to barrage his widow with questions. Daily. Incessantly. At the time, I was too young and clueless to realize how painful it was for my mother to be endlessly interrogated about her dead husband by his 10-year-old clone. No, my self-involved ass couldn't seem to connect those glowing neon dots, so I kept right on asking questions, and my mother, trooper that she was, answered them to the best of her ability for as long as she could. Then one day she handed me a small brass key and told me about the boxes up in our attic. Until then, I'd always assumed that my mother had donated all of my dad's stuff to charity after he died, because that seemed like the first thing a young, widowed, single mother who was trying to start her life over would do. But that summer day, my mother explained that this was not the case. Instead, she had packed everything he'd owned into cardboard boxes. And when we moved into our current house a few months later, purchased with the payout from the accident settlement, she'd stored all of them up in our attic. She had done this for me, she said, so that when I grew up and wanted to know more about my father, those boxes would be up there waiting for me. When I finally got the door unlocked and burst into the attic, they were really there. A dozen pristine cardboard moving boxes stacked neatly in a corner beneath the sloping rafters, illuminated by a bright shaft of sunlight. For a long time, all I could do was stand there frozen, staring at this tower of time capsules, waiting for me to unlock their secrets. I'd spent the rest of the summer up in that attic, sorting through it all like an archaeologist unearthing relics in an ancient tomb. It took some time. For a guy who had only made it to the age of 19, my dad had managed to amass an awful lot of stuff. About a third of the boxes were filled with my father's collection of old video games, which was actually more of a hoard than a collection. He'd owned 5 different video game consoles, along with hundreds of games for each of them. I found the real stockpile, however, on his old PC, which contained thousands of classic arcade and console video game emulators and ROM files, more games than one person could have possibly played in a single lifetime. My father appeared to have given it a shot, though. In another box, I found an ancient top-loading VCR. I figured out how to hook it up to the small TV in my bedroom and started watching his old videotapes, one after the other, in whatever order I pulled them out of the box. Most of them contained old science fiction movies and TV shows, along with a lot of science programs taped off of PBS. There were boxes filled with my father's old clothes, too. Everything had been way too big on me, but that hadn't stopped me from trying on every last stitch he'd owned, breathing in the smell as I stared at myself in the dusty attic mirror. I got really excited when I found a box of old cards and letters among his things, along with a shoebox overflowing with carefully folded love notes my mother had passed him during their classroom courtship. I shamelessly read through them all, gulping down new details about the man who had sired me. The last box I'd looked through had been the one that contained all of my father's old role-playing game materials. It was filled with rule books, bags of polyhedral dice, character sheets, and a large stack of his old campaign notebooks, each one outlining the minutiae of some fictional reality intended to serve as the setting for one of his role-playing games, and each one providing a small glimpse into my father's famously overactive imagination. But one of those notebooks had been different from the others. It had a worn blue cover, and my father had carefully block-printed a single cryptic word in the center of it, Phaeton. The yellowing pages within contained a strange list of dates and names, followed by what appeared to be a series of fragmented journal entries, which outlined the details of a global conspiracy my father believed he'd uncovered, a top-secret project involving all 4 branches of the U.S. military, which he claimed were working in collusion with the entertainment and video game industries, as well as select members of the United Nations. At first, I tried to convince myself I was reading an outline for some role-playing game scenario my father had concocted, or notes for some short story he'd never gotten around to writing. But the further I read, the more disturbed I got. It wasn't written like a piece of fiction. It was more like a long, rambling letter written by a highly delusional mental patient, one who happened to have contributed half of my DNA. The journal had helped shatter the idealized image I'd constructed of my young father. That was one reason I'd vowed never to look at it again. But now, the same thing that had happened to him was happening to me. Video games were infecting my reality, too. Had my father also experienced hallucinations? Was I schizophrenic? I had to know what he'd been thinking. Had to dive back into his delusions and learn how they might be linked to my own. When I finally worked up the courage to open the attic door and step inside, I spotted the boxes right away. I'd restacked them in the dusty corner where I'd first found them. They were unlabeled, so it took me a few minutes of shuffling them around before I found the one filled with my father's old role-playing games. I put it down on the floor and began to dig through it, pulling out rule books and supplements for games with names like Advanced Dungeons and Dragons, GURPS, Champions, Star Frontiers, and Space Master. Beneath those was a stack of about a dozen of my father's old campaign notebooks. The notebook I was looking for was at the very bottom, where I'd hidden it from view over 8 years earlier. I pulled it out and held it in my hands and looked at it. It was a battered blue three-subject notebook with 120 college-ruled pages. I brushed my fingertips over the name my father had written on the cover, a name that had haunted me ever since I'd first looked it up. Phaeton. In Greek mythology, Phaeton, a.k.a. Phaethon, is an idiot kid who guilt-trips his dad, the god Helios, into letting him take his sun chariot for a joyride. Phaeton doesn't even have his learner's permit, so he promptly loses control of the sun, and Zeus has to smite him with a thunderbolt to prevent him from scorching the earth. I sat down cross-legged and placed the notebook on my lap, then examined its cover a bit more closely. In the bottom right corner, very small, my father had also printed, "Property of Xavier Lightman," followed by his home address at the time. Seeing that address triggered another flood of memories, because it was the same tiny house on Oak Park Avenue where my Grammy and Grampy Lightman had lived, the same house where I used to visit them almost every weekend when I was growing up. I would sit on their ancient sofa, eat homemade peanut butter cookies, and listen raptly as they told stories in tandem about their lost son, my lost father. And even though these stories they told about their only child were always laced with an undercurrent of sadness and loss, I still kept coming back to hear them again and again, until they both passed away too, within a year of each other. Since then, my mother had been forced to bear the terrible burden of being my main living link to my father. I took a deep breath and flipped the notebook open. On the inside of its front cover, my father had created some sort of elaborate timeline, or, as he'd labeled it, a chronology. This densely packed list of names and dates filled up every centimeter of the cover's white cardstock backing, and it looked as if my father had created it over a period of months or years using a variety of pens, pencils, and markers. No crayons, thankfully. He'd also circled some of the entries before connecting them to other entries elsewhere on the timeline, using an overlapping web of lines and arrows that made the whole thing look more like an elaborate flowchart than a timeline. Chronology. 1962, Space War, first video game, after OXO and Tennis for Two. 1966, Star Trek premieres on NBC TV, airs from 9/8/66 to 6/3/69. 1968, 2001, A Space Odyssey. 1971, Computer Space, first coin-op arcade game, port of Space War. 1972, Star Trek text game, basic program for early home computers. 1975, Interceptor, Tato, combat flight sim with first-person perspective. 1975, Panther, first tank sim, Plato Network. 1976, Starship One, earliest FPS space combat video game, Trek-inspired. 1977, Star Wars is released on 5/25/77, highest-grossing movie in history. First wave of brainwashing and prep for Invader's arrival? 1977, Close Encounters released. Used to program the populace not to fear their impending arrival? 1977, Atari 2600 video computer system released, placing a combat training simulator in millions of homes. Ships with the game Combat. 1977, Starhawk, first of many video games inspired by Star Wars. 1977, Ender's Game short story. First instance of video games as training simulators in SF? Published same year as Star Wars. Coincidence? 1978, Space Invaders inspired by Star Wars, first blockbuster video game. 1979, Tail Gunner, Asteroids, Galaxian, and Starfire all released. 1979, Star Raiders, released for Atari 400-800, ported to other systems. 1980, Empire Strikes Back, released in movie theaters. 1980, Battlezone by Atari, first realistic tank simulator game. 1981, March, U.S. Army contracts Atari to convert Battlezone into Bradley Trainer, a tank training simulator. Army claims only one prototype was ever made, but control yoke design used in many future games, including Star Wars and Phaeton. 1981, July, first Polybius sightings at MGP in Beaverton, mid-July. 1982, E.T. the Extraterrestrial outgrosses Star Wars. 1982, The Thing, Star Trek II, Wrath of Khan. 1983, Return of the Jedi. 1983, Star Master Space Combat Simulator for the Atari 2600. 1983, Star Wars, the arcade game by Atari, and Star Trek Strategic Operations Simulator by Sega, Cabinets Simulate Cockpit. 1984, Elite, released on 9/20/84. 1984, 2010, the year we make contact, sequel to 2001. 1984, the last Starfighter released on 7/13, video game tie-in canceled? 1985, Explorers, Enemy Mine. 1985, Ender's Game novel published, same premise as 77 short story. 1986, Iron Eagle, Aliens, Flight of the Navigator, Invaders from Mars. 1987, The Hidden, Predator. 1988, Alien Nation, They Live. 1989, The Abyss. 1989, Phaeton Cabinet sighted at MGP on 8/8/89, never seen again. 1989, MechWarrior released, another training sim for military use. 1990, Wing Commander, released by Origin Systems, training sim. 1991, Wing Commander 2. 1993, Star Wars Rebel Assault, X-Wing, Privateer, Doom. 1993, The X-Files, fictional alien cover-up created to conceal real one? 1994, Star Wars TIE Fighter, Wing Commander 3, Doom 2. 1994, The Puppet Masters, Stargate. 1995, Absolute Zero, Shockwave, Wing Commander 4. 1996, Marine Doom, Doom 2, modified for use by the USMC. 1996, Star Trek First Contact, Independence Day. 1997, Men in Black, Starship Troopers, Contact. 1997, Independence Day video game tie-in released, PlayStation and PC. 1997, X-Wing vs. TIE Fighter. 1998, Dark City, The Faculty, Lost in Space. 1998, Wing Commander Secret Ops, Star Wars Trilogy Arcade. 1999, Star Wars Episode 1. 1999, Galaxy Quest. The release of the first Star Wars film in 1977 seemed to be the timeline's focal point. My father had circled that entry several times and drawn a series of arrows linking it to at least a dozen other items further down the timeline, including a bunch of video games that the Star Wars franchise had helped inspire, like Space Invaders, Starhawk, Elite, and Wing Commander. Armada wasn't listed on my father's timeline, of course, nor was any other game released in the past 18 years. His final entry was the one noting the release of Galaxy Quest in 1999. I was born a few months later, and by the time I reached my first birthday, my poor father was already fertilizing daffodils at the local cemetery. I spent a few more minutes puzzling over the timeline before turning my attention to the notebook's first page, which contained a pencil drawing of an old-school coin-operated arcade game, one I didn't recognize. Its control panel featured a single joystick and one unlabeled white button, and its cabinet was entirely black, with no side art or other markings anywhere on it, save for the game's strange title, which was printed in all capital green letters across its jet-black marquee, Polybius. Below his drawing of the game, my father had made the following notations. No copyright or manufacturer info anywhere on game cabinet. Reportedly, only seen for 1 to 2 weeks in July 1981 at MGP. Gameplay was similar to Tempest, vector graphics, 10 levels? Higher levels caused players to have seizures, hallucinations, and nightmares. In some cases, subject committed murder and or suicide. Men in Black would download scores from the game each night. Possible early military prototype created to train gamers for war? Created by same covert op behind Bradley Trainer? Back when I'd first discovered the journal, I'd done a quick internet search and learned that Polybius was an urban legend that had been circulating on the internet for decades. It was the title of a strange video game that had only appeared in one Portland arcade during the summer of 1981. According to the story, the game drove several kids who played it insane. Then the machine mysteriously vanished, never to be seen again. In some versions of the story, Men in Black were also seen visiting the arcade after closing time to open up the Polybius machine and download the high scores from its databanks. But according to the internet, the Polybius urban legend had already been debunked. Its origins had been traced back to an incident in the summer of 1981 at a now-defunct arcade right here in Beaverton called the Malibu Grand Prix. Some kid collapsed from exhaustion after an asteroid's high score attempt and got taken away in an ambulance. Accounts of this incident were apparently conflated with another rumor circulating in the arcades at that time about how the Atari arcade game Tempest caused some of the kids who played it to have epileptic seizures, which was actually true. The Men in Black part of the urban legend also appeared to have roots in reality. In the early 80s, there had been an ongoing federal investigation into illegal gambling at various Portland-area arcades, and so during that time, there really had been FBI agents spotted around local game rooms after closing time, opening up game machines. But this was to check for gambling devices, not to monitor gamers' high scores. Of course, none of this information had come to light yet when my father had drawn his sketch of the Polybius game in his notebook sometime in the early 90s. Back then, Polybius would have just been a local urban legend circulating around the very arcade where it had been born, Malibu Grand Prix, the same arcade my father had frequented when he was growing up. On the second page of the notebook, my father had drawn an illustration of another fictional arcade game called Phaeton. My father's sketch of its cabinet was far more elaborate and detailed than his sketch of Polybius, perhaps because he claimed to have seen the game in person. Across the top of the page, he'd written, "I saw this game with my own eyes on 8-9-1989 at Malibu Grand Prix in Beaverton, Oregon." Then he'd signed his name. According to his drawing, Phaeton had a sit-down, cockpit-style game cabinet, which was sort of capsule-shaped, like a Tron light cycle, with fake laser cannons built into each side of it, making the game itself look like a starship. Weirdest of all, it had doors. According to my father's sketch, the cabinet had two clamshell-shaped hatches made of tinted plexiglass, one on either side of the cockpit seat, which opened straight up like the doors on a Lamborghini and sealed you inside while you played the game. He'd also drawn a schematic of its control panel, which featured a four-trigger flight yoke, buttons mounted on each armrest, and another bank of switches on the cockpit ceiling. To me, it looked more like a flight simulator than a video game. The entire cabinet was black, except for the game's title, printed in stylized white letters across its side. Phaeton. I hadn't been able to find any mention of a video game by that name when I'd tried looking it up on the internet 8 years ago. I took out my phone and did another quick search on it. Still, nothing. According to the internet, there had never been a video game called Phaeton released anywhere for any platform. That name had been appropriated for lots of other things, including cars and comic book characters, but there had never been an arcade game released with that title, which meant the whole thing was probably a figment of my father's imagination, just like the Glaive Fighter I'd just seen half an hour ago was a figment of mine. I glanced back at my father's illustration of the Phaeton cabinet. He'd drawn an arrow to the umlaut over the capital E in the word Phaeton printed on its side. Next to the arrow, he wrote, "Umlaut conceals hidden data port plug for downloading scores." As with his Polybius drawing, he'd made several bulleted notations down below, an apparent list of facts about the fictional game. Only seen at MGP on 8-9-1989, removed and never seen again. No copyright or manufacturer information anywhere. Plain black game cabinet, just like the eyewitness descriptions of Polybius. First-person space combat simulator. Gameplay similar to Battlezone and Tail Gunner 2. Color vector graphics. Men in Black arrived at closing time and took game away in a black cargo van. Also very similar to Polybius stories. Link between Bradley Trainer and Polybius and Phaeton? All prototypes created to train/test gamers for military recruitment? I studied both the Polybius and Phaeton illustration for several more minutes. Then I flipped ahead to the journal entry describing Battlezone. 1981. U.S. Army contracts Atari to convert Battlezone into Bradley Trainer, a training simulator for the Bradley fighting vehicle. It was unveiled at a worldwide TRADOC conference in March 1981. After that, Atari claims project was abandoned and only one prototype was ever produced. But the new six-axis controller Atari created for Bradley Trainer was used in many of their upcoming games, including Star Wars. This part of my father's conspiracy theory, at least, was true. From what I'd read online, a group of U.S. Army consultants really had paid Atari to rework Battlezone into a training simulator for the Bradley fighting vehicle, and the United States Army really had pursued the idea of using video games to train real soldiers as early as 1980. As my father had also noted on his strange timeline, the Marine Corps had run a similar operation back in 1996, when they'd modified the groundbreaking first-person shooter Doom 2 and used it to train soldiers for real combat. If he'd lived to see it, my father's timeline probably would have also listed the release of America's Army in 2002, a free-to-play video game that had been one of the U.S. Army's most valuable recruiting tools for over a decade now. An Army recruiter had even let us spend a half hour playing it at school just after we'd finished taking the mandatory ASVAB test, the Armed Services Vocational Aptitude Battery. I remembered thinking it was pretty weird that we were being encouraged to play a video game simulation of warfare right after being tested on our aptitude for it. I continued to flip through the faded pages of my father's notebook, marveling at the time and energy he'd spent researching and puzzling over the details of the elaborate conspiracy he'd believed he was uncovering. Lists of names, dates, movie titles, and half-formed theories were scribbled across every page. But, I realized now, my 10-year-old self had been too hasty in dismissing it as gibberish. There was at least a hint of method lurking behind his seeming madness. It looked as though the existence of Bradley Trainer and Marine Doom were two of the key pieces of evidence behind his vague, half-formed conspiracy theory, along with the classic science fiction novel Ender's Game, and two old movies, The Last Starfighter and Iron Eagle. My father had highlighted the release dates of these items on his timeline, and later on in the notebook, he'd devoted several pages to describing and dissecting their storylines, as if they held crucial clues about the grand mystery he was trying to solve. I smiled down at the list. I'd never even heard of Iron Eagle until I saw it mentioned in my father's journal and watched the VHS copy of it I found among his things. The film had instantly become one of my go-to guilty pleasure movies. The hero of Iron Eagle is an Air Force brat named Doug Masters, who learns to pilot an F-16 by cutting class to sneak into the base flight simulator. Really, just an incredibly expensive video game. Doug is a natural pilot, but only if he's rocking out to his favorite tunes. When his dad gets shot down overseas and is taken captive, Doug steals two F-16s and flies over to rescue him, with a little help from Lou Gossett Jr., his Walkman, Twisted Sister, and Queen. The result was a cinematic masterpiece, although sadly it appeared to be recognized as such by me alone. Cruz and Deal had both vowed never to sit through another screening of it. Muffet was still always happy to curl up and watch it with me, though, and our repeated viewings of the film, along with the Snoopy vs. the Red Baron album my mother insisted on playing every Christmas, had served as the inspiration for my Armada pilot call sign, Iron Beagle. When I posted in the Armada player forums, my avatar was an image of Snoopy in his World War I flying ace getup. I glanced back at his timeline once again. My father had drawn circles around the entries for Iron Eagle, Ender's Game, and The Last Starfighter. Then he'd added lines connecting them all to each other. And now, for the first time, I finally understood why. All three stories were about a kid who trained for real-life combat by playing a video game simulation of it. I kept flipping pages until I came to the journal's second-to-last entry. In the center of an empty page, my father had written the following question. What if they're using video games to train us to fight without us even knowing it? Like Mr. Miyagi in The Karate Kid, when he made Daniel-san paint his house, sand his deck, and wax all of his cars. He was training him, and he didn't even realize it. Wax on, wax off, but on a global scale. The journal's final entry was an undated, rambling, half-illegible, four-page-long essay in which my father attempted to summarize the threads of his half-formed conspiracy theory and link them together. The entire video game industry is secretly under the control of the U.S. military, he wrote. They may have even invented the video game industry. Why? Aside from his fictional Polybius and Phaeton drawings, he never gave much in the way of evidence, just his own wild theories. The military, or some shadow organization within the military, is tracking and profiling all of the world's highest-scoring video gamers using a variety of methods. Then he detailed one example, Activision's high score patches. Back in the 80s, the game company Activision had run a popular promotion in which players who mailed in proof of a high score in the form of a Polaroid of the high score on their TV screen, received cool embroidered patches as a reward. My father believed Activision's patch promotion had actually been an elaborate ruse designed to obtain the names and addresses of the world's highest scoring gamers. At the end of the entry, using a different colored pen, my father had added, "Much easier to track elite gamers now via the internet. Was this one of the reasons it was created?" Of course, my father never actually got around to specifying exactly what he believed the military was going to recruit all of the world's most gifted gamers to do. But his timeline and journal entries were filled with ominous references to games, films, and shows about alien visitors, both friendly and hostile. Space invaders, E.T., The Thing, Explorers, Enemy Mine, Aliens, The Abyss, Alien Nation, They Live. I shook my head vigorously, as if it were possible to shake out the crazy. Nearly two decades had elapsed since my father had first written all of this stuff in his journal, And in all that time, no secret government video game conspiracy had ever come to light. And that was because the whole idea had been a product of my late father's overactive, perhaps even borderline delusional imagination. The guy had grown up wanting to be Luke Skywalker or Ender.